This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In my opinion, for what it's worth, Joe Mantegna is one of the best American actors today. He's also probably the leading interpreter of David Mamet's writing. Mantegna starred on Broadway in Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross and Speed the Plow. He starred in David Mamet's films House of Games, Things Change, and the new film Homicide. You may also know Mantegna as Joey Zaza, the elegantly dressed mobster in Godfather III. In Woody Allen's film Alice, Mantegna was the saxophonist Mia Farrow has an affair with. In the new film Homicide, Mantegna plays a detective who has no life outside his work. He's close to no one but his partner. His greatest gift as a cop is as a talker, the cop with the silver tongue who can persuade anyone to cooperate. The role is perfect for Mantegna because he, more than any other actor I can think of, uses his voice to show the musicality of how people speak. And Mamet writes dialogue that turns colloquial speech into poetry. In this scene, Mantegna is talking to the mother of a killer, trying to convince her that the only way to save her son is to turn him in.
Listen to me. I know that it stinks. I know that there's so much death in the world. I know that it's full of hate, Mama. I know that it all turns out wrong. Here we are. Here we are. We're the garbage men. You think I don't know that? I know that. Looking for something to love. You got something to love. You got your boys. That's something. Look in my eyes. I want to save your son. Before God, I want to save your boy. Will you help me?
After hearing Joe Mantegna in scenes like that, I wanted to know if he thinks of his lines in a musical way and how he thinks out where the accents and pauses will be in each line.
I studied acting for a couple of years at the Goodman School of Drama, which was the Goodman School of Drama, is now DePaul University here in Chicago. And one of the more beneficial courses there was, you know, scoring a script and being able, in other words, to take the material and read it like a piece of music and understand, make notations and understand that if when you're given a certain sentence, there's a variety of ways that sentence could be delivered, depending, of course, on which word you're going to emphasize or just the lilt of your voice or this, that, and the other. Because David Mamet has obviously put a lot of attention into writing just the right wording and the right punctuation to get his point across. So it is intentional, and I appreciate writing that's done with that much thought, because it forces me to give it more attention and give it more respect, so you're not so cavalier about, you know, what you're saying.
Do you ever improvise within a Mamet script, or is everything, you know, as it is in the text?
Well, I would say that improvisation in terms of the dialogue is pretty minimal and should be.
Why should it be?
Because you wouldn't... Some writers write with the freedom for verbal improvisation in there. I've worked for Woody Allen. Now, with Woody, he will give you that freedom. In other words, but it's intentional. In other words, Woody will write his dialogue, but it isn't written totally in stone. And, of course, coming from working a lot with Mamet, as I have, my initial reaction when I first was working with Woody was I would give him exactly every word he has written it. You know, I'd improvise in terms of my delivery and things like that, as I do with any material. But he, early on, like at first or second day of shooting, I remember him saying to me, he says, oh, listen, Joe, you know, don't feel like you're locked to these words. You know, if you want to add some stuff or you just want to go with it or, you know, change this, that, or the other, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. And so, oh, well, okay, once I had that signal from him, then there were instances where I would, you know, vamp or riff or whatever words you want to use for it as to making alterations as to what I'm saying. But that's Woody's style. That's the way he works, and that's how he writes. Of course, if he wasn't getting what he wanted, he'd be the first one to say, well, maybe don't say that. Say something else.
Right.
But where with David, it's a different ballgame because he just writes differently. He's a man who has... Specifically, I mean, he writes in iambic pentameter, so it's not unless a person naturally speaks that way, it would be a little risky to just say, well, I know you wrote this line, Dave, but I think I'll say it this way. No, that's not the way you do it. I mean, it's the same thing, again, making that Shakespeare analogy. If you're doing a sonnet from Shakespeare, you don't say, well, here, let me just put this in my own words. I think it'll sound better.
Is Homicide written in iambic pentameter?
I mean, I haven't sat down with a metronome and counted out, but I would say yes. I mean, I would think that everything he's written is within those rhythms. I mean, I don't know how strictly he adheres to it, and it's not important. It's just like good music. You don't, if you really enjoy it, you don't stop and say, "Oh, you know, wait a minute, that's a 4/4 beat or a 2/4 beat," or you know what I mean. It's how he wrote it. The rhythms he has written it in shouldn't be so obvious that it becomes a glaring, noticeable thing. It's a thing that's just there, and it's part of the beauty of the material.
Well, you know, you play a cop who's very alienated both from, I mean, the guy's got no family, he's got no personal life, he's really seems to have no friends outside of his partner, and he's even alienated from a lot of the cops that he works with. And in the last scene particularly, all of that alienation, because there's been a couple of final betrayals, really register on your face. And I was really wondering what you were thinking about during the shooting of that last scene to get that kind of dazed alienation on your face.
Well, I tell you, it all led toward that. I mean, playing that role, it was a monumental role for me. It was the most difficult role I've ever played, and certainly in film, partly because I'm in, outside of the first minute of the movie, I'm in every frame. And that translates into working 12-hour days, day in, day out, consistently, week after week, under very harsh conditions, in very unpleasant environments, dealing with some very serious and disturbing things. And that starts to wear on you after a while. So it really wasn't that difficult in a way to draw on those kinds of emotions and to maybe let those emotions seep out through my expressions, my demeanor, whatever the camera happens to pick up. I think when you're that embroiled in it, that kind of stuff starts to seep out through you. I felt that it did for me anyway, whether or not it was effective and if people, you know, pick up on that in seeing the movie, you know, great. But in a way, you control some part of it, but a lot of it I had no control over, and it was okay because I felt a lot like this person, this Bobby Gold. I even told David when we wrapped the film that of all the characters I've played for him, this was the one I was going to miss the most because I liked the man very much.
Yet you seem so different from him. I mean, you've been married a long time. You have two children. You seem to really, you know, like having a family. Everybody, you know, when I read about you, everybody has such wonderful things to say about you and how you'd never say anything bad about anybody else and how nobody has anything bad to say about you. Well, so it seems like such the opposite picture of this kind of isolated, alienated fellow that you play.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I enjoy my life. I mean, my family, my friends, I feel I live a very fortunate life. And I feel blessed to have that life. But yet I think all of us, even those of us who have been so fortunate to have had, you know, a wonderful life, there is that little bit in them, that isolated thing that almost I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, but it's like you're born alone and you die alone, that almost kind of thing in you that says, I mean, we used to joke about it, with a phrase of, hey, you know, we're all in this alone. And there's some truth to that. So that it's not so difficult to get into that mindset, you know, if kind of forced to, when I mean forced, meaning you're playing a character and the dialogue and the writing and everything orchestrates itself to put you in a bag that's very different than what you really are, perhaps, as a person, because I still feel we all have these kinds of aspects of, you know, no matter how fraternal we are, how much family we have, there's that solitary person that is ourselves that's, you know, we have to still deal with. And it's just tapping on that, you know, the loneliness of those times that we've all been lonely in our lives. And so it's just tapping on that and expanding on it and creating a character who's pretty much wrapped around in my case, let's say the Joe Mantegna, who's had these very lonely, isolated moments in his life, and just stringing them together and saying, "Now this is a guy who's had a hell of a lot more of them."
Can you think of one of those moments that you're thinking of in your life that you'd be able to share publicly?
Well, I, as I'm thinking about it now, I remember it was about 20 years ago. I just starting off my professional career as an actor. I was in my early 20s, and I remember it was a holiday. I think it was it was my birthday. That's what it was. It was my birthday, and things were all going actually very well for me. But my birthday is in November in Chicago. That's a pretty cold month. And for whatever reasons, and I can't even remember specifically why, there was nobody around for my birthday. And I remember I was in my apartment, and it wasn't a bad time in my life. As I said, I was working, things were happening. But for whatever reasons, there was nobody around. I wasn't involved with anybody at that time. And I remember sitting in my apartment. I was eating some tuna fish casserole that I had made for myself. And I remember sitting there eating it thinking, I guess I should be doing something. I should go out somewhere and do something. It's my birthday. I think I was 22, 23 years old. And I remember this terrible feeling of loneliness, of like just wanting to talk to somebody or just share something with somebody. And obviously it did have some impact on me for me to recall what I was even eating at that time.
Yeah.
And to be able to tell you right now. So thinking of moments like that and thinking that this is a character that perhaps has spent a lot of birthdays doing that, and a lot of holidays doing that. That helps you really tap into certain kinds of feelings for, you know, the character, a guy who basically lives for his career, who lives for his job, and that's the only thing that gets all of his attention, and everything else is just his own personal life is a long string of eating tuna casseroles by himself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Mantegna, and he stars in the new movie Homicide, which was written and directed by David Mamet. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Mantegna, and he stars in the new movie Homicide. He also co-starred in Godfather 3 and in Alice, House of Games, Things Change, and other films. I want to ask you about your role in Godfather 3. You played Joey Zaza, the gangster with the finest suits, and he's taken over the illegitimate Corleone business interests, and his people are dealing drugs, and he's basically going to war with the Corleone family. Did you feel a special sense of occasion working on Godfather 3? Because Godfather 1 and 2 have been such an important part of our lives, you know? I mean, they're such great films, and to like make another sequel, especially after so many years, everybody's going to wonder, well, does it measure up or not? But one way or another, it's an occasion to film another Godfather film.
Yes. Going into it, you know, people, you can say to yourself, well, is this going to measure up? You know, is it going to even measure up to, in my mind, in other words, because for me, Godfather 1 and 2 exist as two of the greatest films ever made. I mean, period. But that, while it enters your mind for a moment, beyond that, my feeling was, it doesn't matter. I don't care. That's not the point. I'm going to be doing Godfather 3. I'm going to be part of that team that's going to complete this trilogy. And my feeling was, it's going to be, you know, I'm in good hands. I'm with the man who created this thing, you know, Francis Coppola. We're going to do this movie. I'm going to work with these people that I've watched in this saga over the last, you know, almost 20 years. So it was a great, great thrill for me to be part of it. And it's a great thrill for me now, having done it, to be a part of it. And I'm very proud of that movie. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. And I think it's a fitting end to that trilogy of films.
Yeah, I like the film a lot, too.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I think it took some shots that I think were almost, I think in retrospect, in other words, down the line, I think it will find its niche, in other words, within that framework of those three films. And it's, to me, it is the appropriate ending to that saga, and I'm very grateful to have been a part of it.
I thought you had exactly the right amount of kind of menace and style and all that kind of like public relations flair that that certain gangsters have.
Well, I felt that Francis, in a way like Mamet, writes and directs in a certain kind of a style. And for me, his style is almost operatic and almost regal. I mean, there's a scene in Godfather 3. It's a scene that I'm in and at the it's supposed to be a meeting of all the dons in Atlantic City. And there's a scene where they're passing around a table with jewelry and they're each picking, you know, rings or whatever, things of value, as to be taking his tribute almost as gifts. I mean, that scene itself to me struck me as being so ancient Rome or something right out of, you know, the Renaissance. It had a majesty to it, and to me that was how I tried to key into my character, that even though it's very contemporary, it's, you know, it's now, it's America, it's this world of gangsters and, you know, cops and robbers and whatever, but yet underneath that there's a certain kind of style and sense of almost you know, regal royalty kind of thing. You know, these are the princes and dukes and earls of this profession. And that's what I found really interesting about it.
I say to all of you, I have been treated this day with no respect. I've earned you all money. I've made you rich, and I asked for little. Good. You will not give, I'll take. As for Don Corleone, well, he makes it very clear to me today that he is my enemy. You must choose between us.
I thought you brought some of the same musicality and style to your lines that you bring to Mamet.
Well, that may be, and maybe that was on Francis's part it was intentional, on his part maybe to you know, have a character that had it. Maybe something of that there. I don't know. But again, like I say, sometimes it's hard for me to separate, you know, who I am as an actor and yeah. who I am as a person. And, you know, I try not to self-examine it too much.
A lot of people assume that the Joey Zaza character that you played in Godfather 3 was in part modeled on John Gotti because they're both, you know, the mobsters with the best wardrobe, you know, with the finest suits. Did you look at any Gotti news clips or anything like that?
No, because I never used Gotti as my, you know, role model for the role. I mean, if people wanted to make those assumptions, that's fine. But my feeling was it goes much broader than that. I mean, that's an obvious comparison you could make. But yet, those kinds of characters in gangland lore have existed a lot longer than the current, you know, John Gotti thing. I mean, you know, Bugsy Siegel was a very, you know, dapper, well-dressed guy. So were a lot of, you know, Legs Diamond. So in other words, that kind of fastidious, kind of well-groomed kind of character is not, you know, there's more history to that than would exist, you know, just in contemporary times. And so the clothes are different, but basically the demeanor is basically the same. You know, in other words, a guy who wears $2,000 suits is going to walk and talk and act a little differently than a guy who's wearing stuff from Kmart.
Did you know any guys who had $2,000 suits?
Oh, yeah, I know guys who have $2,000 suits. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Cicero, Illinois, so there was a lot of guys with $2,000 suits walking around. But, you know, it's helpful in the sense of being able to recall drawing on that image of guys who dressed very expensively who seemed to have nothing to do at 3 o'clock in the afternoons on weekdays, you know. So I always used to struck me as being very incongruous. It's just like, gee, my dad's at work. I wonder why he isn't.
I enjoyed the recent episode of The Simpsons that you did where you play like a neighborhood gangster and Bart becomes a wise guy. how did that come about? You're working on that show.
They pretty much just contacted me through my agent. I think they just, you know, had an idea of that kind of character and thought I might be the right actor to play it. And so it was a lot of fun for me to play a cartoon character.
How did you change your voice for The Simpsons?
I just started talking like this, that's all. Just make a little alteration and you become Fat Tony.
I mean, that's, you know, changing your voice as an actor is, you know, this is, you know, Carpenter has to change hammers once in a while too. So it's just, you know, you make those adaptations as you need to.
You seem to be at a new stage in your career. You're much better known than you were, you know, just a couple of years ago. Is there a difference in the kind of screenplays you're being sent now and the types of roles that you're being asked to read?
Well, somewhat. I mean, I'm certainly getting more offers to do, you know, what I would have considered leading man roles, you know, years ago. And also, since I wasn't doing leading man roles years ago, it is kind of new for me. I still think of them. I think of any role as a character role, though. If it's a leading, what someone else would call a leading man role, in my attitude is, well, it's a character role of a leading man, because that's just my background. I've played all kinds of character roles all my life, so there, you know, there's more often are there's roles where I get to kiss the girl, you know, which I instead of shoot the girl, you know, which I perhaps had a bigger career doing. So it's an ongoing evolution. I just hope to continue to be able to work with people who are at the top of their game. To me, that's the biggest thrill, to be able to work with the David Mamets, with the Coppolas, with the Woody Allens, with the Barry Levinsons, with the Peter Yates, with the Michael Apteds. That's the thrill, you know. Work with Nick Nolte, work with Al Pacino. This is what anybody in any profession wants to be able to do, work at the top of their game, and that's, for me, been the ultimate thrill.
One last question. What's the difference between playing a leading man as a leading man and playing a leading man as a character actor?
Less makeup, I guess. That's all. You know, I usually tend to just walk on the set and say, no makeup here. Just, you know, just let me know if my hair's in my eyes and, you know, cover maybe this one little blemish that, you know, looks like it's ready to go. Outside of that, let's just wing it, you know.
You have a say in that? I'm surprised.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think when you're first starting out as an actor, you're willing to, like, just trust everybody and say, oh, yeah, go ahead. Do what you will with me and throw me out there, and I'll just, you know, and I won't say a word, and hopefully you'll just pay me and send me home. I think later on, as you start to do it, you realize, hey, look, regardless of everybody else's input, it's your mug that's up there for, you know, maybe 50 years from now. As I'm looking at the old Bogart movies, some other little kid's going to be looking at my movies and say, that's that Joe Monte. Yeah, oh, yeah. We heard he was an actor back in the, you know, the 90s. So that's what he looked like, kind of, you know. So, no, I think it's important you have a say in that somewhat, you know.
And you don't want somebody looking at it 50 years from now saying, but how come he was wearing eyeliner under his eyes?
Yes, exactly. Jesus, you know, he doesn't seem the type to be wearing that much makeup. So, yeah, I think it's important to have some input.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Joe Mantegna, and he stars in the new movie, Homicide. This is Fresh Air.